This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Giovanni Donato.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, Giovanni, it's great having you back on.
Yeah, again, good to be here.
So I think the last time we talked, you had a series on social status, and before that, you wrote about the post-scarcity economy. Your most recent articles, there hasn't really been like one specific theme, but I noticed you've been kind of touching on the topic of neo-tribalism.
Well, I previously was touching on social status and in a reference to a post-scarcity economy, because social status causes things to be positional, like they're going to adjust relative to the market, even if you give someone a universal basic income. And you have to account for how a neo-tribe is going to work as well with its own internal ladders of social status. One theme I did focus on in my newer articles was on the social capital, which is what, you know, the chutes and ladders that give us access to the people we need in life and the relationships we all desire. And I point out that while we're on paper, this is quite a rich society, perhaps the richest in world history, that the social capital is, good social capital is actually quite scarce.
So a lot of people who complain about their lives, I mean, I don't really want to, it's kind of like there's this kind of conservative cliche, and they, conservatives will rant about how poor people have it good because there's a, because they have iPhones, that's kind of a cliche, but we do.
It's ridiculous, of course.
Yeah, it's ridiculous because,
I mean, those things contribute to quality of life. Sure, they're nice to have, but those aren't the deepest motivations that keep people happy or even sane. I think that's another commentary on social capital and its scarcity in those poor environments. They're even more poor in high quality social capital than they are in cash. Clearly, there's cash floating around in the ghetto.
To go over these articles in chronological order, your most recent one we can touch on is Suburban Populism Beats Rural Traditionalism in Mass Identity Politics, and this was back around the time of the election of where Roy Moore lost in Alabama, and you critique his core message because he pretty much,
I think my core
he pretty
message
much
was,
ran on a socially conservative platform, like the platform of your southern religious right of the Bible Belt.
I think my criticism was pretty widespread through the dissident sphere that he failed to incorporate immigration as a main plank of his platform. At best, he was dog whistling or hinting at it, while putting his ideology, his fundamentalist ideology, front and center. And I was fine to go along with that. I mean, it's Alabama, what could go wrong? But when he actually lost, I mean, that's a huge eye-opener, that strategy is just flat-out not viable anymore. And while it was shocking, it also shows the way forward for us, that we can't go back to Reaganism. We have to move forward into the populism, though we're still figuring out how exactly to do that.
Because basically what the conservative movement was, the so-called Conservative Inc., it was a coalition of foreign policy hawks and economic conservatives and the religious right, and that coalition fomented around Ronald Reagan, and that's pretty much fallen apart, and that's not viable. And I mean, I reject mainstream conservative ideology. I'm not really a conservative. But the key question is, I mean, something has to replace that, and you're advocating more of an economic populism.
I advocate more of an economic populism for regular people who are just trying to pay the bills. I recognize there is an ideological and philosophical structure that motivates people from the alt-right to NRX or any number of strains of dissident. They aren't just motivated by paying the bills. They're looking for a fundamental reorientation of society. But they're a small number, and they need to interface with the vast majority of people who they often refer to as normies.
And those people, they're not as you said, they're not thinking about things like race or IQ. That's not at the top of their head. They're thinking about basically how are they going to pay the bills and just get by.
Yeah, most people are just working a job, and they don't have time to read these essays and pursue the course of the red pill. And you know, I sometimes think, who can blame them? I mean, nobody pays you to learn those things, and it could put you at odds with the people you know in real life.
And as far as Trump's original demographic went, I think he struggled with the well-educated, upper-middle-class suburban voters, but he did do better with working-class suburban voters. And a lot of those people are more secular than traditional Republican voters.
I think the single biggest thing that's holding back populism as a movement is the class divide between the upper middle and the working classes. They see each other as natural enemies. But as I've even spoken with you on previous podcasts of how I see Bernieism and Trumpism as two sides of the same coin that will ultimately need to work together. I think that will ultimately happen as demographic pressures rise. It's just a question of when. There's a guy who calls himself Stixenhammer, I think, who was in a debate with Richard Spencer and Sargon of Akkad. And I think just today he was announcing that some of his views had been changed in reaction to the excesses of the left. I think some of the Bernie progressives, populists, are beginning to cross over.
So you're saying there's a class divide where Trump supporters are primarily from the working class. So Bernie Sanders supporters, a lot of them they're struggling economically, that they have a student loan debt, but they tend to be more from a SWPL backgrounds.
Right. The Bernie people tend to be people who aspire to that slot in academia or the upper middle class white collar job, but haven't made it yet. And they're losing faith that they will make it and are trying to get their inroad. So which is that they still kind of aspire to that is, I think, one of the reasons why they are very reluctant to reach out to the working class side of the aisle.
And a lot of the divide is more cultural than it is economic. But with the whole political situation we're in now, on one hand, you had the whole sort of a Charlottesville incident with the far right versus the far left, and that increases division between the dissident left and the dissident right. And you see a lot of Trump's policies as being more in line with mainstream conservatism. So just the logistics of an alliance of the alt-right and the dissident left, like the Bernie Sanders supporters, I'd like to see that, but the current political situation that we're in, it could happen in the distant future, but in the short future, it looks like those two groups, I don't really see them working together that much.
I think the 2020 election will be pivotal in this. They didn't quite get it in 2016 that the minority vote is what ultimately blocked Bernie Sanders from being a viable nominee. And if we see that happen to them a second time, they won't be able to ignore it any longer.
And it looks like the Democrats are going to go with someone like a Cory Booker or...
I think that's what's going to happen, that they'll get their Booker, their Harris, their Gillibrand, or whoever it is. They'll be hoping at least maybe even a Warren can get in, but I think it'll be kind of like when they tried to insinuate Keith Ellison as a compromise party chair, who's a black Muslim, but also ideologically in line with the progressives, and even he was soundly rejected by the establishment, and they showed who was really still in charge. I think they'll just find more of that going forward. I don't think the Coalition of the Fringes really wants to do business with them, and I don't think there's any way they're going to learn that for good except the hard way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they'll vote for Trump, but I do think that this sort of overlap, I think it will happen, but it's going to take some time. I think it's going to be a long-term trend.
If they go third party, that's good enough.
Yeah, that could very well happen.
Yeah, in the American political system, I mean, your coalitions are already formed. So if you go third party, you're protesting and saying that your votes are on the table for anyone who will cut you into their coalition. And that's good enough if they do that or even just stay home.
Back to what you said in that article touching on Roy Moore. So you're saying that suburban voters are more crucial than the rural voters.
America has since slipped past the point of being a majority urbanized nation. More than half of the country either lives in the cities, the urbanized areas, or the suburbs surrounding them. And I think more and more of the mainstream culture, even in places like Alabama now, is starting to be more centered around the suburban mentality. And that was a wake-up call when the guy with the cowboy hat who rides to the polls and the horse is defeated in an area where it should never even have been a contest. If that strategy can't succeed in Alabama anymore, it can't succeed anywhere.
You wrote this article, Dissident Success Requires Cities, and a lot of political dissidents, they're always talking about retreating into places like Idaho, Montana, or South Dakota. But it's your point is that to be influential, it's crucial to be in these places of power.
Yeah, I feel like the far right has romanticized this retreat into the wilderness since at least the early 90s, probably earlier. Especially around stuff like Ruby Ridge and Waco and all that. And they still have some of that in their ideological DNA of retiring to the rural compound with their guns and canned food. But the reality, since long before the birth of Christ, is that power centralizes in the cities, and that's also where people meet and form ideas. And I also noticed that schools of ideas often arose from people who actually knew each other face to face, went drinking together. I mean, this holds true for the 19th century romanticists. I mean, Lord Byron, the Shelleys, they were all best friends who hung out and went on international vacations together. Guys like Adam Smith and Hume, they hung out in Edinburgh and had beers together. These were social clubs, and those are best formed in the cities.
Are you talking about primarily medium-sized cities, like, say, Salt Lake City or Cincinnati? Or do you think it's even crucial to have communities in New York, L.A., and San Francisco Bay Area?
Maybe you could make do with the mid-sized cities these days with the automobile and the internet allowing you to at least get some of the preliminaries of figuring out what you want to talk about done. But what I'm noticing is the internet has been an incredible tool for putting together a platform and an ideology. But if the censorship and so on were totally taken away, it's reaching the end of its marginal utility and diminishing returns. And I notice a lot of the dissident groups are focusing more on public outreach and rallies and getting out in public now. They realize that.
And also, it's important because cities are where most of the high-paying jobs are.
Yeah. And that's where most of the high-IQ people are. That's where most of the culture is. That's where the ideas are formed.
And
it's always
been
that way.
Yeah, then you convert other people to your ideas.
Yeah. Now, I readily point out it does come with structural problems. Like as Spandrel says, it's a gene shredder. Cities have always been population sinks that relied on a more fecund countryside for reinforcements. And there's a possible mechanism in the rise and fall of civilizations because they burn up their best people in the cities. And that's a structural problem that needs to be worked on.
Are you saying that people move to the cities and the population starts to decline?
Historically, the cities have always discouraged people having children, and there's always been high rates of mortality. I mean, obviously, a first-world modern city solves some of those problems, but other problems like sky-high rent just to get a small flat are still there. That makes the security and space you need to have a family very difficult to obtain.
And if you look at the major metropolitan areas, the ones I mentioned, L.A., San Francisco, Silicon Valley, New York City, there's a major inflow of immigration, but the number of American citizens that are there is rapidly declining. But do you think that problem could be solved with immigration control?
I mean, absolutely. Look at places like Singapore or Hong Kong. Not just anybody can run into those cities. I mean, there's a clear concept that they have a very limited space, and not just anybody can go in and live there. And that may have to come into the West, I think. You can't just have vast underclasses of millions on that precious real estate around the cities where all the productivity is happening.
So would these neo-tribalist communities that you're talking about, would they sort of function on the model of ethnic enclaves, like the Chinatowns?
I could see it kind of starting like that. Take the process of gentrification in cities like Washington and New York. You start out with a few hipsters and gay people moving in, and they carve out a rough niche, and then it gradually frees up other people to move in, and the place still has a feel of its founders.
And by neo-tribalist communities, are you just talking about in an ethnic sense, like white people, or you're talking about more specific cultural niches?
I mean more specific cultural niches. I guess I use the term neo-tribal instead of referring to a race. I mean, look at the huge rivalries within within European peoples, the so-called white race. And look at how so much of what defines the dissidents is cultural affiliation. I think ethnic is maybe a bedrock, but when you're building finer affiliations on top of that, and then you have something more like a neo-tribe. I think it becomes neo-tribal when you have actual bonds of loyalty and shared social capital between a group of people, not just living near the same shopping mall.
How would the whole problem of the population sink be addressed? Because even Singapore has a pretty low birth rate.
I think suburbs, the modern suburb, as bland as they can be, have already helped with that some. And the excessive amount of time people spend commuting. But I think another easy step, a low-hanging fruit, is simply to be to make it less easy for underclasses to settle in the cities and give preference to people who are going to make more productive use of that, and thereby, because when violent underclasses live in these neighborhoods and make them inaccessible to productive people, that just penalizes your social cooperators by making them pay more for rent. And when they have to, when their whole lifestyle is more expensive, it's harder for them to settle down and have a family. So as we discussed previously, family formation has a lot to do with social status and social politics as well. But I think those are pressure valves that would at least help with the problem of gene shredding in the cities. Oh, I think it's doubly important to solve that now, because the countryside isn't the huge resource of new bodies that it used to be. I mean, it still is a higher fertility rate than the cities, but more like 2.2 instead of 5.0 like it would have been.
Oh, and remember in our last show you were talking about that community you lived in Korea. Do you see something like that as a model? Or did you find that to be too overcrowded?
No, that's the thing. As I've discussed before, it didn't feel that crowded, even though, because the high-rise buildings made it so you didn't have a huge sprawl of residents. That was a major red pill experience for me, that a dictator centrally planning this town was more successful in of an outcome in my mind than the unlimited sprawl that you see in many cities in the U.S., especially as you go further west.
And you could have a functioning community in a place like that. A lot of these problems were low levels of social trust, where people are becoming more socially disconnected. A lot of it does have to do with just bad urban planning, where people have to drive everywhere and shop at these like strip malls.
Yeah, you don't really have, it doesn't really encourage mingling or serendipitous encounters. And in this Korean town I lived in, it was like 500,000 people there, and it was, most of it was easily walkable. You could easily walk or bike from one person's high-rise to another.
How would the issue of a class, both the social and economic status, function into these neo-tribalist communities that you're talking about?
I imagine they would have their own parallel internal hierarchies. If only because any human group is going to have those things. That's just human nature. Obviously, people who don't fit into one neo-tribe are just low status there will probably seek out another if they aren't getting what they want.
And then you'll sort of have this, some tribes will have higher status, so the lower status people of one tribe will drop out. Instead of being stuck in a low status, they'll drop out and form another tribe. I mean, it's kind of a parallel to like modern day nerd culture, but you could see that forming.
Or you can look at some of the what the Antifas do, the so-called alt left, not what I think of as the alt-left, where they will...
So when you talk about the alt-left...
Where they basically ritually disfigure themselves, but it gives them higher status within that group. They maybe sacrifice some status to the larger culture to increase their status within that smaller pool. And the alt-right does that too. They do things that make them persona non grata in the larger culture, but which makes them a high status within the alt sphere.
And a lot of these movements, I mean, this goes back to the whole discussion that we had on social status, where people disparage their political opponents as having low social status. But a lot of people who don't have social status in just day-to-day life, they join these subcultures, and then they carve out a niche, and they gain social status there.
Yeah, people look for arbitrage with social status, just like you might with currency trading.
With the whole issues of cities and suburbs, a big issue has traditionally been the issue of white flight out of those areas. Do you see that trend continuing, like a massive white flight out into the rural areas, or do you see some kind of reversal of that? Because that kind of goes against your theory of people moving back to the cities.
I think that first you have to solve some of the problems that are causing white flight, like encouraging the mass settlement of underclasses in the cities. I think it helps to solve that, so you have lower crime rates to start out with, and the rents would be a lot lower.
And I mean, just take an issue like the H-1B visas. If that program was ended, then the Silicon Valley could end up being like a magnet for the best and brightest from all over the country to move to.
And the settlement of underclasses also severely limits the utility of public transportation. I mean, that's an important truth of American life, I think, that people don't want to be on buses or subways that are heavily populated by the underclass.
And conservatives tend to be hostile to mass transit, but they frame it either on economic terms or they frame it on terms that, oh, that's part of UN Agenda 21, like, we need our single-family home. But you're basically a mainstream conservative won't explicitly say that. They just frame it on economic terms, like it's a waste of taxpayer money.
Right, so if people weren't fearing these people who had settled in the cities, it would be more politically viable to improve infrastructure and make people less dependent on the automobile, have light rail systems out to the suburb like you do in practically every major international city that's not third world outside of the United States.
Back to kind of what I touched on briefly in the beginning of the show, what do you think about the whole issue of the conditions of the underclass, the argument about whether the underclass has it good, or the conservative argument, because they have all this, they say, oh, the conservatives say they have all this free stuff, versus the left's argument that the underclass are severely marginalized and economically disenfranchised?
This is an ugly topic that people don't like to talk about, honestly. A lot of them are lower IQ and lack the traits for success in a modern first world society, no matter where you put them. And in my writings on basic income, my general thought was to basically take care of them but not have an Irish potato famine or a Highland clearances, try to avoid that kind of brutality, but also not encourage them to reproduce en masse or even fade them out. I would hope that the underclasses could be treated humanely, but that condition is only really possible in conjunction with eugenic policies that don't allow them to take advantage of aid by spreading en masse.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Both the left and the right neglect this, but the main problem in society is that wealth is concentrated too much at the top, which the left says, and they're correct about that, but then the population is concentrated too much in the underclass, so we have these two problems, and nobody really looks at the big picture.
I mean, we can look at the whole continent of Africa that's approaching over a billion people in population right now. And without modern medicine and Western aid, that growth isn't really sustainable. So in a lot of ways, people's good intentions are paving the road to hell. A really horrible hell if things went wrong.
You wrote this essay, Lebanon Predicts the Future of the USA, and it's important to point out with that country, their demographics changed in a fairly short period of time. It was had a pretty strong Christian majority about 100 years ago, and then it went to being from like 70% Christian to about 70% Muslim within the period of one century, so that just shows you how significant a demographic change can be.
Well, part of the problem was the Sykes-Picot, Europeans messing around. They made the territory of Mount Lebanon larger than it had been as an Ottoman province, including a lot of the other peoples around there. And they left them with a parliament system based on ethnic group quotas. So that there was between three ways between the Christians, the Sunnis, and the Shiites. It was fairly evenly matched. And of course, nowadays, I mean, Christians are, 30-40% after there was a mass exodus of Christians in the war. Many of whom are now the elite class of South America and Central America.
So your article, you talk both about the whole parliamentary system where these three groups, Christians, Sunnis, and Shiites, they vie for political power. And you also talk about the situation of the Civil War, and you make parallels to the future of the United States if we continue to Balkanize. What parallels do you see, and what scenarios do you see as likely?
I felt like Lebanon was a useful model because it's a densely packed area around a single big city and its suburbs for much of this tiny country. And I felt like it paralleled in some ways in America, where you have in every major city, you have enclaves of every major ethnic group, and they're packed in close proximity. And I felt Lebanon was a model of what happens when you have that setup and civil order breaks down. Or at least once the peace is restored, you get an idea of what the politics between those ethnic groups looks like. And what you see with Lebanon, even in the peace, is shifting alliances. When you have the three big groups, it's always two allying against who they perceive to be the stronger.
So are Christians generally more aligned with the... I think today they're closer aligned to the Shiites, but I'm not sure about the Civil War.
In recent years, they were more closely aligned with the Shiites and Hezbollah because they were afraid of ISIS. But one thing I mentioned in my article is I wonder how that will change now that ISIS is no longer a huge threat. And now that the Saudis have played a role in alienating the Lebanese Sunni community by basically abducting for a while the Sunni prime minister.
So you're saying you think that the next conflict will, if there is a conflict, it will mostly be a Sunni versus Shia one?
I mean, given this Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince's heavy-handedness, I could see him maybe getting together, say, with the Israelis, and then encouraging the Christians and Sunnis to put more pressure on Hezbollah. I mean, he already detained Saad Hariri, in the Lebanese Sunni prime minister in Saudi Arabia, so he could try to pressure him to put more domestic pressure on Hezbollah and the Shiite community. I mean, when the guy must have refused his what he was asking him to do, I mean, he actually took this guy and put him on the national TV in another country, and from another country made him announce his resignation. Pretty foul play and heavy-handed politics that immediately backfired on him, which is one reason, just another reason I think this bin Salman guy is bad news. For one thing, he's making himself into the George W. Bush of Saudi Arabia with his pointless wars and confrontations all around.
Yeah, he's almost like a Muslim version of like a neocon. He's instigating war with Iran. He's a really bad guy.
Yeah, other than trying to fight Shiite proxies, I can't imagine what strategic gain the Saudis have in Yemen. I mean, even back in the days of Arab nationalism, Nasser tried to fight a war down there too, and it didn't help him any. It's just it's a quagmire of the Middle East. I can't understand why they would want to commit their resources there.
And Yemen's not even that important from a geopolitical standpoint compared to, say, Syria.
No, not really. I mean, best thing it has going for it is its access to the sort of a choke point on the Red Sea. I mean, the British had a huge base at Aden, I think. But I don't think it's really that important now. And the areas that the Saudis are interested in are attacking these mountains in inland. So, other than fighting there, just because their enemies have people there, I don't see any real strategic goal.
So, with the parallels to the United States that you made in that article, most likely there'll be a sort of neo-tribal situation where these different ethnic groups are vying for political power. And right now, there's this whole sort of thing where it's liberals versus conservatives. In the future, do you think we'll still have that? Or do you think it'll just be like people will vote based along ethnic lines?
I think it's already happening. I bet with every subsequent election from now on, there's going to basically be a de facto white party. It's already happening. The Coalition of the Fringes sort of are hardcore believers in their ideology, and they're only encouraged by the elites that form their ideology and egg them on.
So with this whole Coalition of the Fringes, it's basically white liberals and all the different minority groups, but I don't, in the long run, I don't really see that as sustainable. It'll probably break apart.
No, I think the resentments are just too strong. And one of the dynamics I noticed in Lebanon, those who perceive themselves as weaker always form a coalition as who they see as the stronger. And they aren't going to make fine distinctions of different types of people within that group. Like, there's a saying in the Red Pill sphere, a lot of them like to say, you may not be interested in race or ethnicity, but it's interested in you. And I think it dawns on a lot of people in circumstances like employment situations, for example, where you can no longer ignore it.
And there's these different ideas people point out, these different concepts people point out. There's colorblind civic nationalism, which, I mean, the left is going to say Trump is a racist, but for the most part, I would say Trump's movement has, his core supporters are promoting civic nationalism or American nationalism, and that's not really sustainable in the long run. And then then there is the whole concept that Richard Spencer points out of an ethnostate. I see the chances of that as being pretty slim. So that pretty much leaves a most likely outcome to be this sort of neo-tribalism that you're talking about.
The fascinating thing with this civic nationalism is how utterly it's collapsed in the last few weeks. Roy Moore, in many ways, was kind of a death blow to that. Bannon, for example, stacked all his chips with Roy Moore. And that's been, as far as I can see right now, kind of the end of him is a huge influence. His movement is stillborn at this point. And right now we're figuring what fills that vacuum. What we're left with at the moment is populist policies like immigration and labor.
And with Trump, it's really hard to say where he'll go, because he makes these comments, like he'll say these comments like, oh, I don't want people from shithole countries, and that could be interpreted a certain way, and the left obviously is going to say that's a white supremacist or racist comment. But for the most part, his actual legislative accomplishments have pretty much been your standard Republican Party policies.
A frequent criticism at this point. So I think his influence over the culture is still seen as a valuable contribution in most parts of the dissident sphere, which I would disagree with, despite his shortcomings in policy. those tax cuts were definitely kind of demoralizing, but ever since he said shithole countries and now we have this shutdown, it seems like we're, now that it's an election year, the confrontation is more coming out again, and I'm, at the moment, I'm happy with that.
And the Democrats have gotten more militant on the immigration issue. They're explicitly an open borders party. Before they tried to maybe pay lip service to being more nuanced, but now they said, we want full amnesty, we want chain migration. So you're seeing this intense polarization. And that's just going to force...
Which is great. Ever since the election, it's been clear that the coalition of the fringes is destined to paint itself into a corner.
I really don't think that the white Bernie Sanders supporters want all that stuff.
No, and what they needed to do is make some concessions to their white supporters, but that's not... They're maneuvering, they're thinking on an emotional level.
So with this concept of an alt-center, which we've talked about in previous shows, that's basically the end result of a fusion of Bernie Sanders' movement, which you could say is alt-left, with the alt-right.
Yeah, the what we could say is alt-left, not the Antifas, is more oriented towards cities. It's a more urban culture, more middle class, especially upper middle class culture, more concerned with the development of aesthetics, which I think is one of the next big frontiers for the dissident movement, by the way. I feel like it's actually between the neo-reactionary movement and the alt-right, I feel like they've sort of hammered out a workable doctrine at this point and need to move into the real world. And a part of that means establishing culture and aesthetics, which I believe we discussed previously, and which I've written about before. But I've actually begun trying my hand at some fiction for the first time in many years, and even some poetry.
What have been the general themes?
I actually am putting the finishing touches on a dissident-themed fantasy fiction story, because I think you need to begin with mythology.
So it hasn't been published. It hasn't been published yet.
I'm talking with with what I would say is a neo-reactionary blog right now who might be interested. I'm discussing with them.
I have a book out. You should check it out.
Yeah, I remember alt-left, formerly known as alt-left, saying he was editing it.
Oh yeah, it's out now. I can send you a. If you're willing to review it, I'll send you a free PDF.
Sure, I can help you with that.
So with the alt-center, basically what Brandon Adamson is advocating on his blog, altleft.com, that's pretty similar to what you're advocating for an alt-center. He puts a strong emphasis on culture and aesthetics.
Yeah, I see how he likes to go shopping for bargain clothing, for kind of that casual 70s or 80s aesthetic, and he likes to discuss those weird or offbeat period films. But yeah, that focus on aesthetics, I feel like, is part of the more left-wing upper middle class populism, an element that the more literal and material right-wing populism won't succeed without.
Because, yeah, as far as the culture and aesthetics go, the right wing has traditionally kind of fetishized things. They haven't really valued aesthetics. A lot of them are content with, like, track housing and Walmarts.
Yeah, I often admire that they can get down to the brass tacks and reduce things to the necessities and the first principles. But you need something more than that to inspire people.
Can you comment on your article about the scarcity of social capital, how that sustains institutions?
I comment in that article how I mean, look how the last 20 years there's been article after article predicting that universities are going to go downhill as an institution because it's all on the internet for free now. But on reflection, you realize the university is more dominant than ever, with more people going than ever, with access to degrees being a major part of political platforms, is because it's still a status ladder that offers access to things that most people couldn't get without it. It offers access to the common culture of people who get degrees. I think a lot of getting hired is just having the same experiences of going to college that other people working in that white-collar sphere have, so you can relate to them. For example, before that, I mean, what's the main concern you see that people have with something like, say, homeschooling, even if the kids are learning a lot better? They always cite socialization.
Because, so a lot of homeschooled parents are, they might be brilliant, and they can inform their children in a much, from an intellectual standpoint, they might do a better job, but they're going to have low social capital.
Yeah. And in some ways, people are smart and streetwise to understand that cultivating the social capital is more important than what you know.
Because
for all but the most skilled professionals.
In society, people are conditioned to think that success is based purely, it's a combination of intelligence and hard work. But that basically takes away the whole issue of social capital and social status.
The hard work's for nothing if people don't value who you are or care about you. You're just a cog then. And to really get anywhere, you have to have a group of people around you who care if you live or die or if you're thriving. And that's one of the reasons I think neo-tribes or something like that, it's inevitable. That's a niche for demand that goes unmet in this so-called bowling alone culture.
I know the blogger Lion of the Blogosphere, he writes a lot about these issues. Would you describe him as basically alt-center?
I do, because he likes to talk about culture and aesthetics. He also talks about the brass tacks of the job and housing markets. And he recognizes the reality of human biodiversity, but he doesn't make discussions of race or race hate a central part of his platform. He doesn't obsess about it.
And that's basically what the alt-center would be.
Right. You can basically be red-pilled on the JQ without making that one of the main things you want to talk about or even interested in.
I think Lion of the Blogosphere even, I hear him complain that the alt-right is too anti-Semitic.
Yeah, well, he would be in a position to do that, I suppose. He's a New York Jew.
Yeah, that makes sense. But so an alt-center would touch on these issues like HBD, it wouldn't just focus narrowly on that.
I guess I feel like part of being alt-center is I can recognize the reality of an abusive Jewish elite, but still recognize the value and contributions of someone like Lion of the Blogosphere, or just enjoy a Steven Spielberg movie.
This is slightly off-topic, but it does tie in with social status. You did write about the whole sexual harassment scandals, and you said sexual harassment hysteria seriously undermines the establishment?
Yes, because I think people look up to these people and they want to be them because they can have what they want. But when they have to answer to these rules like a common office worker would, and get turned in and dragged to the mud by people who are much lower status than them, that really harms their legitimacy. Like, they lose that aura of invincibility and coolness.
Well, what you said is there was an alliance between feminism and men with high status, and it's kind of, this has caused friction between those two groups.
Yeah, on some level, feminism always was it began as these wives of upper class and middle upper class men who were encouraged in their political activities by their husbands. The more freedom for women seemed like a cool thing to them. And the women, even down to the working classes, saw their husbands spending money on other things in the families and tried to basically use the state to establish more control over their provider figures. That was a main cause of the temperance movement. So their guys couldn't just go out and drink liquor every night and blow their pay.
And this ties in with the whole social status show we did, but it's a pretty common narrative on the alt-right, where I hear a lot of alt-right guys say that, oh, red pill men are alpha, and liberals and blue pill people, they're all a bunch of beta cucks. And I think that's sort of people want to, like, find these, like, easy narratives, but the reality is a lot of guys who join dissident movements, like the alt-right, a lot of them, you do have a lot of nerds or guys who are, I guess, could be described as neets, and a lot of high-status men would be described as blue pill because they're benefiting from the status quo.
Yeah, we sort of discussed before, I think these dissidents are kidding themselves if they think they're all alpha chads now just because they're dissidents. I mean, the POA blogs even spell it out. I mean, some element of it has to come naturally to you. I mean, you can sort of improve what you got, but you also have the base material you're working with.
And it's also a convenient way to kind of pigeonhole your political adversaries. So you see it on both sides. So the liberal establishment is going to say that the alt-right is a bunch of losers, and then the alt-right is naturally going to want to respond and describe liberals that way.
I would never really discourage them, actually. It's very highly effective rhetoric for their audience.
It is effective.
That's how you really hit people below the belt, is attacking their notions of sexual desirability.
I think there was a recent ABC piece about the alt-right, about that book called Kill All Normies, and they even flat-out said that.
I mean, you could, even a lot of these dissident movements, they began with guys just talking about women. That is sort of like the base primal need of men, once their stomachs are full. And it was a rallying point for people to start talking about other things.
Since we're kind of on this topic with neo-tribalism, most of these online movements are primarily movements of young men. Do you see it as starting out as movements of young men and then eventually leading to men, women, and families? Or do you see a sort of permanent state of it just being a bunch of men?
No, I think it starts out that young men are always going to be the pioneers. They carve out a space, and if it's a decent space, other people want to follow. And I feel like a lot of these groups are already working on that. Like, for example, look at a lot of Identity Europa's activism and outreach programs. I've even seen some stuff where they just go out and pick up litter. Like, anything that makes them seem a benevolent group in their area.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Just to kind of summarize things up, what do you want to say about the overall topics of, we talked about neo-tribalism, the importance of cities, and we also talked about the alt-center. If you want to just kind of comment on all these issues and bring it all together.
I feel like these dissident groups, whatever people call them, have over the years sort of put together an ideology and a doctrine that people can agree on after years of talking through the internet. But I think most of these groups realize now the next frontier is to interact in person and establish a presence in their local communities and build up power from there. I think we sort of see a merging of the alt-right and neo-reactionary perspective in what's happening on the ground. A middle ground between activism and quietly building up social capital and networks of friends.
And do you see that as happening with the dissident left as well? And I don't mean the Antifa, I mean the positive elements of the left.
I think they still... I think the right-wingers are a lot more organized than they are at this point. The Antifas, of course, are known for being organized, but the Bernie Bro organization, to the extent they have it, seems a lot smaller still. I think they will still need a traumatic experience of getting shoved aside by the coalition or the fringes to really galvanize them into action and organization of their own.
I think in the long run, you'll see this fusion, but it may take a couple of election cycles of being marginalized and sidelined.
Yep. I think Kamala Harris 2020 would put things well on that path.
And you even see this, you see aspects of the alt-right picking up left-wing political views, like the positive aspects of the left?
I feel like organizations like Richard Spencer and his people and Identity Europa have been particularly successful at that, though it's surprising the influences I see even with League of the South and trad workers from time to time. The more rural working class elements as well seem to get some inspirations.
And those groups, like there's the trad, I think they're called the trad youth or the trad worker party. They're economically populist, but they tend to be hardcore social conservatives. So they're going to appeal more to the
kind of... An interesting blend.
They're going to appeal to the traditional working class, I think, voter, the traditional working class demographic. So then you can also have people with more socially liberal views, like Brandon Adamson and altleft.com. So I think it's okay.
Right.
It's okay to have like a Big Ten coalition, a Big Ten approach.
And they have writers like Occidental, like Hunter Wallace and Matt Parrott, who seem like pretty smart guys, and they're good writers too.
And I noticed Hunter Wallace has actually really gone against Trump lately.
Yeah, he is. To be fair, he realized it wasn't going to be a populist administration as soon as he saw where the cabinet was heading. And he does take it up to 11, though, but I feel like maybe someone like him needs to be there for balance.
What do you think about a site like the UNS Review, which has a coalition of a dissident left and dissident right writers and a few libertarians?
You mean like Carlin?
Oh yeah, Carlin. Someone like Anatoly Carlin, but just the site in general as well.
I would think of them as, I guess someone like Carlin could be more of an alt-centrist because he's not, he seems like very technologically oriented, but he's not quite a neo-reactionary technocrat. He's not really obsessed with race, though he's HBD. And he doesn't really focus that much on the aesthetics and culture as much. So I'd say he's also squarely in the center.
Yeah, he did put out his political compass quiz and he got centrist. And you know what? I actually did the same thing because I took the political compass quiz and I pretty much got centrist.
So, yeah, I feel like I've fallen someplace in between these factions as well, though. I probably interact with the most and fall closest to the neo-reactionary community.
Yeah, that's the thing is, people like us, in some regards, we're more centrist, but I think it's the issue is that political correctness creates this barrier, and it forces you to socialize more with the right side of things, even though you don't necessarily agree totally with the right wing. Political correctness kind of does create like a barrier.
Right, like a lot of neo-reactionaries, for example, some of them want to go back to like this ancient form of Catholicism, but if I talk to them on politics, we generally agree on 90% of things. And like we were saying, the dissident Bernie left, or which is becoming more dissident, doesn't really have an organization to interact with or join yet.
So I'll call this show Alt-Center Neo-Tribalism. How about that?
Sure thing.
Well, Giovanni Donato, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
My pleasure. Good to be back.